Hello, friends. Dr. Ken Berry here. Today, I have the great pleasure and honor of chatting with Mr. Gary Taubes. He's an investigative journalist. He's written numerous very important books. I can remember very well on my lunch break reading The Case Against Sugar and Good Calories, Bad Calories back when I was practicing medicine full time and being blown away by the insights and the paradigm shift that this gentleman brought to the discussion. I think before his books, we were all just really fumbling around in the dark. We knew that the standard American diet and the food plate and the pyramid guidelines didn't work, but we really didn't have an alternative. And in any time that you're going to attempt a revolution, you got to have an alternative to offer people. And so I think Gary did a great job of offering the science and the theory behind, hey, you know, maybe this is the way we should actually eat. So enough of my chatter. Let me bring on the Right Honorable Gary Taubes.
Ken, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's always a pleasure. Yeah. We've hung out a couple of times and chatted at conference, brainstormed over a drink one time in Seattle, I think it was. And this guy has been an integral part in my transformation from just a standard Western trained doctor to somebody who recognizes that, you know, just an offhand mention of diet with a patient, that's not really doing a thorough job as a doctor. I need to talk about nutrition, and I need to talk about nutrition a lot, because as I've come to understand and believe, if your nutrition is not proper, no amount of medicine is going to fix what's wrong with you. And so welcome, Gary. We're going to be talking definitely about your new book that's been out for a few months, The Case for Keto. If you guys don't have this book, you need this book. There is an Audible version for my fellow ADD sufferers, so you can listen to it while you do something else. Also, Kindle, paperback, hardback. I don't know. You may even have a spiral bound. How's it going, Gary?
It's going well. I mean, I'm working on my next book, and I'm not, despite being a journalist and a writer, I'm not a fan of writing. So there's a sort of Sisyphusian aspect to my day, which is, you know, wake up, push the rock up the hill, and then try to do a better job the next day. But other than that, things are well. And,
Excellent. You know, I actually am starting work in earnest on my second book, which is tentatively titled The Proper Human Diet. And my first book, Lies My Doctor Told Me, was kind of an act of love. I felt called to write that book because of all the egregious foolishness that I saw in the practice of modern medicine. This book, I also feel called, but you're right. It's a trudge. It is a labor of love to write a book. It's not fun and not easy, at least not for me. It's work.
Well, not for me either. So it's that's one of the reasons why I, you know, if you think I got it right, my reporting was so good, was because the longer you're reporting a story, that's fun. Investigating, learning, digging up the roots to our beliefs, and then the evidence base for those roots is fun and challenging. And then you have to take all that and synthesize it into something people can read and understand. And, you know, in effect, I've now written four books that are either different ways of synthesizing the same information or unpacking sections. Like The Case Against Sugar was taking what was a chapter in Good Calories, Bad Calories, and then giving it the book treatment it deserved. And even then, that book could have been three times as long if I didn't care whether or not people could get through it, which... Yeah. So it's an interesting problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking with my editor and they said, how long do you see this book being? And I said, well, somewhere between 150 and 850 pages, somewhere in there. So I'm not real sure yet, but I'm going to try to keep it as succinct as possible. But it's so much fun. I agree with you. It's so much fun kind of going down the rabbit hole and reporting what you find as you go, that it becomes really hard to cut off parts of the story. It almost feels like you're cutting off a family member. We've got people from Finland, Brisbane, Australia, Georgia, Ontario watching right now. Where are you guys watching in the world? What city, what state, what country? Tell me in the comments. So, Gary, your next book, do you want to talk about that a little bit that you're working on?
Yeah, I'm working on a book on diabetes that is becoming a kind of case study in the pathology of medical science. So why is it that physicians, you know, working to improve the condition of their patients are almost constitutionally incapable of establishing reliable knowledge about whether or not the interventions they're giving will ultimately make their patients better or worse.
Yeah.
In this case, you with diabetes, you have diabetes pre-1921. Before the discovery of insulin, diabetes was seen as a carbohydrate intolerance disorder. And the standard of care, more or less, since about 1780 was what they called the animal diet, which was a fatty meat diet with green vegetables that were not only were only green vegetables, but you boiled them three times to get all the carbohydrates out of them. So it was effectively a ketogenic diet. The physicians of the era didn't really understand what they were doing, but they knew that since their patients couldn't metabolize carbohydrates, that a diet without carbohydrates would keep those patients that we would now say have type 2 diabetes, it would basically keep them going indefinitely, and it would prolong the life a little bit about patients with type 1 who are insulin dependent. Once insulin comes along, you need insulin saves the lives of the patients with type 1 diabetes, and now you need to feed them carbohydrates to balance the insulin. So you go from feeding, in effect, no carbohydrates or a semi-starvation diet, depending on who you believed at the era, to feeding them, giving them insulin and balancing the insulin with carbohydrates. Within 3 or 4 years already, patient doctors are saying, look, our patients don't want to be on a diet. Why not just let them eat whatever they want? They're going to do it anyway, and just give them as much insulin as they need. And you have, the fascinating history of how the fear of fat, even in the 1920s, and fed into this idea that let's just give them the drugs they need and let them eat a more and more liberal carbohydrate diet. And so that's the history I'm telling. I think it's a fascinating and important book, but I can't imagine who's going to read it.
Me and about 10,000 of my people are definitely going to read it 100%. I hope that there is a good, thorough thrashing of the American Diabetes Association in your new book.
Yes, you know, there is a thread. This is what, so the chapters I've been working on these past months, you know, up until World War II, you've got basically diabetes specialists fearing, you know, why do we see so much heart disease in our diabetics? And they don't really understand it, and they're arguing for better control. And then post-World War II, you get the first oral hypoglycemic agents. So they start testing those. They never test diet. That's one of the themes of the book. They never test diets until Eric Westman and Will Yancey in the early 2000s say, geez, I wonder if this original diet is better than what we're doing now. And then the ADA, the American Heart Association, buys into this idea advocated by Ansel Keys that fat is the primary evil in modern diets. And the American Diabetes Association goes along with it. And once again, it's a story of one or two very prominent physicians forcing their belief system on an association that then promulgates these beliefs to, you know, in this case now, tens of millions of Americans. They never test it. They never ask whether the AHA is right. The hypothesis is being tested. This is a story I've told in Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat, and A Case Against Sugar, and it keeps coming back. But the American Diabetes Association should take full responsibility. But I do believe at the time they were acting in good faith, right?
At the time, but now over the last 5 years, I'm not so sure anymore about them.
Once you get so invested in your hypotheses, right, that you've been giving the wrong advice for 50 years, how do you turn around and acknowledge that?
Especially, that's a valid argument if you're talking about widgets or lug nuts or quail eggs. But if you're talking about human lives and the daily losing of them and the daily crippling of them, Yeah, I think you need to hold a press conference and you need to say, okay, immediately stop following all of our dietary advice. All those recipes on the ADA website for chocolate brownies and fruit smoothies, don't make another one of those. They're making your diabetes worse, not better. Yeah, I think when it comes to, you know, the devastation of human lives and human families, you don't get to use that excuse. I'm sorry.
No, that's true. And I agree with you clearly, but, you know, we're still a minority view, right? Yep. So one of the things, and I talk about this in the book, the problem is once you decide you're going to lower the standards for what you're going to accept as scientific truth, you then sort of create an entire scientific community that emerges and grows up with those lower standards. So we no longer have to rigorously test our hypotheses. If enough people believe it's going to be true, we're going to believe it's true.
Exactly.
And so you end up with a situation in which there's this small, zealous group of advocates that includes, luckily, with each passing year, more and more academic researchers and established researchers and scientists, but that we're always a minority. So even if they were to shift and admit that we were right, then they're still left with the majority of the research community who's going to think that they did the wrong thing.
Yep.
And that, so it's, you know, again, in science, I mean, much of the way good scientists think about what they do, the thing you're trying to avoid the most is to accept anything as truth without rigorous proof. Nobel laureate here at the University of California, Berkeley, used to say, never believe what you can't prove, or only believe what you can prove. That was the, and once you do that, the problem is then you create dogmas and institutionalized belief theories, the fixed ideas. I mean, the field is full of them and we're struggling against all of them. But and that's why when I say this is a case study in medical pathology, it's a case study of what happens when you decide you know the truth.
Yeah.
You know, the cholesterol story, I keep coming back to it and it never ceases to amaze me. It's like 1880s, German pathologists say, look, these atherosclerotic plaques are full of cholesterol and fat. And cholesterol happens to be one of the things you can measure. So by the 19-teens, and one guy pumps up chickens, a Russian pumps up chickens with cholesterol and sees, you know, arteriosclerotic plaques accumulating. And so, voila, there's your cholesterol hypothesis. They can never get off it.
Yeah. And it's really sad. And typically, when I first started my medical career back in 2000, 2001, the way that information came to primary care doctors, I'm a family physician, internal medicine doctors, med peds, pediatricians, OBGYNs, is that our regulatory body, in my case, the American Academy of Family Physicians, they have a journal and they have conferences. And so they would kind of trickle down to the doctor in the trenches like I was. This is the latest guidelines. This is the new thinking. Here's the new medications. But I'm seeing a very curious thing happening over probably the last 5 years, and it seems to be increasing in velocity. And that's the instances of patients teaching their doctor about nutrition and diet. And I think in the case for keto, I think you kind of really touch on that in a very eloquent manner. But basically, somebody will use keto, low carb, carnivore, ketovore, any of the low carb options on the what I call the proper human diet spectrum to reverse either one or several of their chronic medical conditions. They'll stop anywhere from one medication up to six or seven medications. They look 10 years younger. They act 20 years younger. And they go see their doctor for the routine checkup. And the doctor is looking at the patient and looking at the chart thinking, the nurse must have gave me the wrong chart. This is not the same person.
Right?
And then the patient proceeds to unload. The good news about the keto that did this to them. And the first time that happens, I suspect that the doctor's like, wow, what a kook, right? Who, you know, Miss McGillicuddy's lost her off her nut. But there's a curious thing. Primary care providers, what we do is pattern recognition. Very, very often we look for patterns. We look for trends. We look for things like that. And so when that first patient comes by, you just, it's a coup, no big deal. But then what do you do as a primary care physician when the 10th person comes with the same exact story? You're like, what's going on here? This is weird. I'm going to Google this keto thing tonight. I'm going to check to see what this is about. And then when the 100th person comes, it's like the 100th monkey theory, right? When the 100th patient comes in here, once again, you think you've got the wrong chart. And you're like, what the hell is this keto thing? All of a sudden, the doctor becomes curious. The doctor also remembers, oh, I'm a student as well as a teacher and a healer. I'm also a student. And so they go back to keto school. They start looking at it. And I can't tell you the thousands of both primary care physicians, specialists, and mid-level healthcare providers who've reached out to me. It's like, okay, I'm woke. I believe this is real. This is a real thing. I've seen too many patients literally transform their lives in ways I could never do. How do I do this? And I've had so many healthcare providers reach out to me, and that I don't think that happened with Atkins. I don't think that happened with Banting. I think this is something, and it may be thanks to social media, but this is blowing up and I don't see it stopping. What do you think about all that?
Well, and for the most part, I agree. One of the reasons I agree is because I've talked to physicians like you. In fact, for this book, I interviewed you and, 120 other physicians, and it's the same experience over and over again. It helps when the physician themselves is from obesity or overweight or diabetes or pre-diabetes or metabolic syndrome or pick your chronic disease so that they can try it themselves and see what happens. I mean, there's a few of our colleagues out there who are always lean and then became pre-diabetic, like Mark Cucuzella or, athletes who had pre-diabetic numbers and then tried keto as an experiment. So it helps if you can experience it yourself. And you can also establish by doing it yourself, not just that it works at least on you to reverse that condition, but that it doesn't kill you in the short term and that your lipid profiles get better. You know, that's kind of an important step along the way. But remember that a lot of this started. It didn't happen with Atkins because the community had no way to, the medical community had the locks on, they were the gatekeepers. There was no internet. So all you could do was read Atkins, and then you'd lose 60 pounds and go to your doctor, and your doctor said, wow, you look great, Joe, what happened? You say, well, I did the Atkins diet, and the doctor, oh my God, you're going to kill yourself. And then he says, you got to go off it. Now you've just been given an excuse to go eat ice cream again and, your favorite pasta dish. And that's the end of the diet. Most people probably fell off either because they didn't fully understand what they were doing, because Atkins, much as I give him credit, didn't fully understand the science, or because they now have an excuse to eat carbs. So it's like getting an excuse for an ex-drinker to go drink again and boom. Yeah. But Eric Westman gets into this in like 1999, 2000, because he is a patient who goes on Atkins. He has that experience. And because he's an open-minded, good doctor, and he can't deny what he's observing, even though he didn't want this patient to go on Atkins, he now goes to Atkins and says, give me money to test this. So the first clinical trials start being done because the same experience 20 years ago with one open-minded doctor. And then when I start reporting this as a journalist, I've now got five physicians around the country, physician researchers who are doing clinical trials because they've had the same experience. And back then it was Atkins. So then when I write my first New York Times Magazine cover story, that's the evidence I have to make the argument that if you restrict carbohydrates but not calories, you're going to improve a lot, not just your weight, body mass index, but your lipid profile and your heart disease risk. So, it even starts before Banting, but the phenomenon we're seeing now is as much as anything because the internet has kind of broken down the gatekeeper phenomena. So now everyone, you can reach out and you can find other doc. People can find you. All these physicians can find you and say, Ken, help me understand what I'm seeing. And they could find me and they could watch our videos and they could watch the podcast. So And yeah, it spreads. I used to talk about this with my co-creator of the Nutrition Science Initiative, Dr. Peter Attia, and sometimes we would get frustrated because of the organizational resistance we were dealing with. And I said, you know, imagine it's like we're playing in a poker game, a poker tournament, and there are 1,000 people in this tournament, and they're all cheating. They're all talking to each other. They're signaling to each other. They're all loaded up to play against us. But the advantage we have is God keeps dealing us aces.
Yep.
Because this works.
Yep.
It does what we say it does. What, maybe we're wrong about the mechanism. I doubt it, but God knows. But you restrict carbohydrates, replace them with healthy fats, people get healthier. You know, end of story. Most people, I don't know what the actual proportion of people is who adhere to this diet and don't get healthier. I suspect it's very small to, you know, but that's not the kind of evidence we have. So yeah, it's, it spreads because it works. Yep. Whether or not it continues spreading in the world, you know, the climate change activists who think none of us should eat animal products and the animal, you know, the people think nobody should eat animals for ethical reasons and all the other reasons people fight back, aside from the medical dogma about LDL cholesterol. I don't know. I don't know how that'll go.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. And I agree with you. I'm not sure that we fully understand the mechanisms by which a very low carbohydrate diet causes all this metabolic healing. But that's okay. Because what most doctors know and most laymen do not know is that for very many of the FDA approved prescription medications, I have an app called Epocrates that has every FDA approved medicine, and it has the indications, the dosages. So if you forget something, you look it up, and it has a pharmacology and mechanism. That's one of the tabs you can click on. And on very many of the prescription medications, you click on that tab, it says literally exact mechanism of action unknown.
Right. Well, this
and
is.
But yet it's FDA approved, and the company selling it's making $1 billion a year, and they don't know how the shit works. Yeah. Now, if that's okay with a pharmaceutical drug made in a chemical factory, then don't tell me, oh, well, we can't recommend keto until, you know, we have controlled research, long-term trials in humans, so we can understand the mechanism. Well, since that's not a requirement for many of the pharmaceuticals, I feel like that's not fair to put that onus on a diet that basically consists of meat and vegetables that human beings have been eating for millions of years.
Yeah, no, and I completely agree with you. But one of the things that happens, it's so fascinating from, so I got into this, my interest is what's known as pathological science, which is a science of things that aren't. So it's not misconduct or fraud in science. It's science just done poorly so that the researchers basically come to the wrong conclusions. That's what my first two books were about. And then I moved into nutrition, and it's rife here. One of the things that happens once you get into a situation where you believe something that's patently untrue, and everybody you know believes it, so you've got groupthink, because the smartest people you know believe just what you do. So it's hard to not go along in those directions, and the associations believe it. You start creating sort of an immune system to protect your beliefs. So, for instance, one of the reasons the diabetic community never tested diets against each other, aside from the fact that they decided dietary fat was bad for you back in the 1920s based on a poor understanding of the evidence, is once they decide that's true, they no longer even feel there's any logic to testing diets. So you don't test diet, and nobody wants to stay on a diet anyway. So that's part of the defense mechanism. We're not going to recommend keto,
yeah,
because it's too hard to comply to. Well, how do you know it's too hard to comply to? Because we know it's too hard to comply to. But what about all these people who clearly comply with it? And we're not complying with the diet. We're complying with, we want to remain healthy. So we gave up certain foods that made us healthy, and now we want to stay healthy. So we're not going to go back to eating those foods. That's what we're complying with. They don't even have to read like our books, my book or your book, because they know they're right.
Yeah. Yeah. It works for me. Why do I want to hear someone else's opinion?
Yeah. I mean, the world is full of quacks. It's full of people who have wrong opinions. I know my opinion is right. Therefore, I shouldn't bother reading any book that suggests it's wrong.
Yeah.
It's kind of, there's all these sort of thought processes that work to protect the dogma. And the dogma is you should eat a balanced diet in moderation, or maybe a Mediterranean diet in moderation. The moderation means if you're prone to getting fat, if you fatten easily, the phrase I use in the case for keto, then you need surely have to eat less. The fact that the diets I'm prescribing have never been tested for a lifetime doesn't really matter, because that's now the conventional wisdom. I believe they're safe based on other conventional wisdom that's also not been tested. Yep. But if somebody comes along and says you should just eat, you know, foods that we evolved to eat, you know, green vegetables and animal products, whether it's good for the animal or not, then I need to see that well tested before I'm going to advocated for my patients. So I want to see a 10-year or 20-year long clinical trial to see if my patients actually get healthier, even though I could try it myself and see if I get healthier. It's complicated.
Right. And I found out a very interesting thing when I was first starting to do Facebook Lives and make YouTube videos. I would have people reach out to me and they'd say, "Hey, I'm type 2 diabetic. Is it safe for me to eat keto? But, you know, how do we know it's safe?" And I was like, well, that's a valid question. I mean, these people, this is their one life, their one health that they're dealing with here. And so I thought, then it occurred to me, I wonder how much research has been done showing that the ADA recommended diet is safe long term for type 2 diabetics to eat. Right. And I thought, well, surely there's some controlled research. Surely they've got at least 20 or 30 people on long term ADA recommendations just to make sure that it's not deleterious. Maybe it doesn't reverse type 2 diabetes. And so I started looking into that, and Gary's already he gave you sign language for what I found. There is zero research that the American Diabetes Association recommended diet is safe for long-term consumptions by either type 1 diabetics or type 2 diabetics. Now, usually when diabetics hear that, they're like, are you freaking kidding me?
Well, not only that,
that they're recommending a diet and there is no research to show that it's safe.
You have to say,
just like the keto diet, there's no research.
You have to say safe compared to what, right?
Right.
Because you got to eat something. So safe compared to what? And then in order, then you got to define, what do we mean by safe? That means if you eat this way rather than that way, and we haven't defined that way yet, we have defined this way. If you eat this way, you're going to live longer and have fewer diabetic complications. What we know is that type 2 diabetes and type 1 diabetes are both progressive chronic diseases that get worse with time. We assume that's inescapable, unavoidable. Okay. And right. The reason we assume that is, well, in part because we've never tested it against any other way of eating to see if maybe that phenomena itself isn't, maybe that assumption isn't true. Again, the history of science tells us you can never assume anything to be true that you haven't rigorously tested. Don't believe what you can't prove. Okay. But in this case, again, you've got several generations now of physicians who have grown up with the belief that this is what we tell diabetics. Okay. Here's the diet. The ADA, they assume it must have been tested. They don't go through what you've done or what I did because they're too busy. We're all too busy to play this kind of game. Or what they might do is read an American Diabetes Association, nutrition principles article and assume that those people did their job. What's interesting is the last time the ADA published its nutrition principles guidelines, the review included a couple of individuals who had spent a lot of time studying low carb, very low carb ketogenic diets and were aware of the literature. And they basically insisted that rather than just say what they always said and assume that the AHA got it right, they said, look, let us find every clinical trial and see what the data really says. And then what they concluded was, the only diet that's been really well tested for diabetes at all is the low carb, high fat or ketogenic diet. All these other diets, Mediterranean, vegan, DASH, et cetera, were poorly tested and the results were inconsistent. they were consistently beneficial with low carb, high fat. And then the joke is, this is just a nutrition guidelines, and they have a standard of care document that physicians write. And the physicians, when they wrote the standard of care document, now ignored what the nutrition guidelines people committee published, because, well, heck, the physicians know what's right. They've known it for 50 years. You don't change your opinion just because somebody has interpreted the data correctly. It's crazy.
It really is crazy. And, you know, we all have different ways, different stories we tell ourselves to explain the world. And, you know, for you and I, I agree with you. I think it's just science got off on a false track back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. The pharmaceutical industry blew up, just exploded with growth. And it became very sexy for a doctor to know the latest prescription medications and to be the first one in town to write the newest prescription for the latest and greatest drug. And it became very unfashionable and blasé to just say, hey, you know, you need to eat a low carb diet. That was not very sexy at all in medical practice. But there are people out there, many people out there, as a matter of fact, who believe that there's some degree of conspiratorial thought by the big food manufacturers and the big pharmaceutical houses making their billions of dollars a year. A lot of people suspect there's some kind of collusion behind the scenes. And that may, to some degree, be true. But I think the majority of the problem is just the science got misled, go ahead. Yeah, talk about that. Yeah,
I agree with you. I've been accused of being naive by my colleagues in the field. But to me, the really powerful force is cognitive dissonance. You grow up believing something, you come to believe it, like I said, and groupthink. Everyone you know believes it. The smartest people in your field believe it. Your best friends believe it. The people you respect believe it. The people who, you know, when you get promoted into your, you know, esteemed positions, it's because you believe it. And then the people we all respect, like we like each other because we think the same way. Right. The people we respect in life are the people we think like, who think like us. This is the essence of groupthink. So you end up in a world, it's like where you go to a church where everyone in that church believes the same thing for the most part. And the few people who are questioning their beliefs tend not to talk about it because then they get excommunicated. And then they have to join another church. And then they end up at the church down the road, which is a church of quacks, right? So you end up with this very, very powerful force to think just like everyone else does and to do what everyone else does. And then if you do research, you interpret it through that prism, those glasses, you see what other people expect you to see and what you expect you to see. So the whole system goes awry. The pharmaceutical industry in this world acts kind of like the sun. You know, a huge gravitational force, because there used to be a joke, you know, if you want to get your laboratory funded, you know, come up with a molecule that could be a drug that could, you know, there's money in, there's salaries, if nothing else, in studying pathways, mechanistic pathways that might lead to drugs. Those don't exist in the diet world. There's no money in the diet world. There's particularly exactly. No money in telling people what not to eat, you know, unless you, right. You know, are coming up with keto food products or whatever, which half the people in our world are. And, you know,
yeah, I'm not a big fan of that. I really believe that you cannot ever scale up real food to an industrial global level. I think that the more you scale real food as a product, the less it becomes real food. And I think that's why we see lots of keto bars and bricks and cakes and cookies and pies and shakes. But there is no billion-dollar market where you can scale up from just a local rancher like me who's got 24 sheep out in the pasture. It's impossible for me to scale that up to a multi-billion-dollar corporation that's worldwide. Because it's real food. It has right. A shelf life. It has real nutrition that suffers from long-term storage. You can't do that with real food. And I think everybody's trying to make a buck, and that's totally cool. That's human nature, right? But I think the one area where I might agree with our conspiracy theory acquaintances is when it comes to the heart hypothesis, the LDL, the HDL, because the pharmaceutical companies that make statins, they've been trying for decades. They've spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to develop a drug that lowers HDL. And they've found several, but every single time in the studies, all-cause mortality is worse if you lower HDL with a medication. And so I'm going to love the day when a class action lawsuit with subpoena power is able to pull all of the backroom documents out of these big pharmaceutical companies. And I think what we're going to see is a replay of the big tobacco hearings in front of Congress and the big paychecks changing hands, because I think in that one regard, I think they absolutely know that LDL is not a big deal. If they thought LDL was truly the thing, they wouldn't be spending hundreds of millions trying to come up with an HDL lowering drug and a triglyceride lowering drug. They just can't find it. They know they know at some level that what they're doing is harming human health.
I'm gonna offer the alternative hypothesis, which is, HDL, low HDL is a symptom of metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, and that's why I don't think these drugs work. It's one reason. It's interesting. Back in the late 1970s, once researchers realized that LDL, that triglycerides were a risk factor for heart disease. I mean, they'd known it since the 50s, but they accepted it based on these population studies. And so researchers who, well-meaning epidemiologists out here at UC San Francisco do an analysis, and they basically say, look, when we control for HDL and weight and, glucose intolerance, the effect and blood pressure, the effect of HDL goes away. It's like when we control for metabolic syndrome or insulin resistance, the effect of a symptom of insulin resistance goes away. So therefore, actually, in this case, it was high triglycerides. Therefore, we're not going to consider high triglycerides an independent risk factor for heart disease, because it's not an independent risk factor. None of them are. Right. So you got to fix the hyperinsulinemia and the insulin resistance. And that's a tricky thing to fix, because now when you're dicking with hormonal responses, you're playing with homeostasis itself, and it's like whack-a-mole. If you knock it down here, it's going to come up and cause problems there, because there's a reason why you're insulin resistant.
Exactly.
And hyperinsulinemic. So I just think the HDL drugs failed, because targeting HDL alone doesn't do any good. You have to target metabolic syndrome and all its manifestations. And the way you do that, it's by cutting back on the carbs in your diet or cutting them out of diet. That's the only way to do that.
That's right.
Get a sort of the proper homeostatic response, when then people get better. But now we're not drug land anymore, and there's no money to be made except writing books. And
right. Exactly. And Pete, the Kiwi is exactly right. I misspoke earlier. What I meant to say was the pharmaceutical houses have spent hundreds of millions trying to come up with a drug that raises
HDL.
Right. Exactly. And they can't find one that does it without causing more problems than it fixes. And I think the reason is because Gary's exactly right. This is a constellation of things that are all interconnected. And when you find the proper human diet, all of a sudden your HDL goes up, your triglycerides come down, your A1C comes down, your C-peptide comes down, all the important markers. And I'm not including total cholesterol in that, because I don't think it's an important marker for heart risk whatsoever. The important markers go back to normal, but there's no one pill that can do that. Maybe if they could make a pill out of the keto diet, that might do it, but I doubt that's possible.
Yeah, no, even then, because I said the problem itself is a response, as I understand it, the problem itself is a response to the carbohydrates in the diet. So you can't create a pill that responds to a body can't deal with the carbohydrates without that pill doing at least as much harm as good, because the response is your body trying to mitigate. You might be able to come up with a pill. Remember, what was that? Procter & Gamble had that fake fat that you didn't metabolize. Alestra, with all kinds of awful side effects, including, if I remember correctly, anal leakage. So you might be able to
create a couple of prescription medications that will sequester sugar, if not carbohydrates, in the gut, They're FDA approved, but the problem is you have unacceptable side effects from
right.
that.
Right. And indeed, yeah, the flip side is just don't eat them.
Yep. You know, or that, exactly.
And again, this is what every time I hear debates, honey, I was on Twitter this morning. I should never be on Twitter. It just eats up your life. And it's the same six people arguing, and God knows if anyone's even paying attention. But this is talk of this carbohydrate insulin model versus these energy balance models, and it goes back and forth. And I believe the carbohydrate insulin model. So what is a carbohydrate insulin model? Carbohydrates are fattening. Okay, why is that so hard to understand? It's not the calories, it's the carbohydrates.
Yep.
Okay, for those of us who get fat,
Twitter.
Yeah, for those of us who get fat easily, we can't eat those foods. Just like I can't eat corn, I can never eat corn because I'm allergic to it. I have GI distress. Yep. You know, I've known this since I was about 6 years old, and so I have to avoid corn. Every once in a while, I go to a theater, I decide I'm going to have popcorn. I do not care, and then I accept the GI distress that follows. You know, the argument is the rest of us, regrettably, probably because of intrauterine effects that were passed on for several generations from our, you know, great-great-grandmothers to our mothers to our, you know, ourselves. These foods make us fat. If we don't want to be fat, we can't eat them. And if we're not eating them and we're replacing the calories, as we're going to have to, because otherwise we'll be hungry, and we're replacing them with fat, you know, we'll lose a lot of weight because we're not eating carbs. If we replace them with protein, we'll be Ted Naaman.
That's right. And I tell people all the time, I don't care if you eat a high protein, moderate fat, very low carbohydrate diet, or a high fat, moderate protein, very low carbohydrate diet. I don't care. Pick which one you like best, which one you believe in, because that
is which one makes you feel better when you eat it.
That's it. And as long as it's very low carbohydrate, you have my blessing.
Oh, and here's the other thing I would do. If you're doing one and you're not getting the result you want, you know, you think you're 90 pounds overweight and you only lost 50 pounds, try the other way.
Yes.
Because maybe for you, you're eating too much fat and you need more protein and less fat. Or maybe for you, you're eating too much protein. You're getting too much insulin from the amino acids that are converted from the protein. And maybe you need more fat and less protein. You know, lot of this, as we've discussed, well, as we will discuss, becomes about self-experimentation. Understand the principles, do your homework, and then the one person we could do clinical trials on is ourselves.
Yeah. And it's so funny, Gary, to see the human nature happening in all this. Even in the keto community, you mentioned Dr. Ted Naaman, who I respect and love him. He's a great guy, but he believes in a high protein, moderate fat, very low carbohydrate diet. And for me personally, that doesn't work for me. That would not be sustainable for me. I've got to have my high fat. It works well for me, but even in the keto community, which you would think that since we're fighting back against this kind of, unidirectional golem of the twin Goliaths of big food and big medicine and big pharma, you would think that we would be more open-minded and that we would be like, no, do what works for you. Try this experiment, try that experiment. But even in the keto community, I'm starting to see these the tribal formation.
Well, we see also
now starting to hate each other.
You know, when we talk about the keto community, and they often that means, you know, on Twitter. And what you're seeing on Twitter is, you know, selects out people who have a lot of free time and want to make their opinions known. I'm not sure it represents, you're seeing a tiny numerator of opinionated people who think that what they say matters. That's true for all of us. I have no idea what the denominator is. And I think the denominator is a world of people who have, for most part, given up carbs and gotten a lot healthier. And, you know, then who knows? But yeah, I'm always getting shellacked because I'm always saying, well, look, that's a nice hypothesis that we would all do better if we ate high protein diets. And the problem is a lack of protein, not too many carbs, you know, but I personally don't see the evidence for that.
Right.
And when I look for the evidence, I don't find anything I find compelling, which is my judgment. And, you know, all I would say is if this doesn't work for you, like I'm like you, first of all, I personally will be happy if I never see a skinless chicken breast again for the rest of my life.
Same.
You know, and same. I also, you know, God help anyone who thinks eating fat-free yogurt is something they want to do regularly. It's not me.
No, me either.
You know, so it's sort of, but I buy that it helps people. I buy that there are people who have tried high fat versions of ketogenic diets, stalled, and then tried, just as I know a few people out there, I've read their, you know, memoir where they're, you know, their stories saying that they lost weight on, you know, the Dr. McDougall's starch diets. Inevitably, yep. They say they tried Atkins, they tried paleo, none of it worked. They don't quite define what worked means. And they say they went to eating potatoes and feel terrific. And if that's true, that's great. It's something you should experiment with. I think for most of us, like we came from a low fat, high starch world.
Yep.
In my case, it was certainly whole foods. It wasn't processed foods. It wasn't vegetable oil, rich seed oil crap. It was whole foods, very low fat, very low fat. And I was getting fatter. I tried Atkins. This was back when keto was known as Atkins. And the result was kind of remarkable. I didn't stick with it. But I did say, wow, this is fascinating. And then as I learned more about the science and the history, I went back to it.
You know, yeah, exactly. Now, let me give you some advice, Gary, and this is coming from my wife. She is my main advisor.
Yes.
And she told me a long time ago, well, just last week we had a discussion. She said, you know, you're wasting time on Twitter, right? She said, how many people a day do you think you help on Twitter? And I was like, probably none. She said, and so here's my wife. This is my wife, Misha, talking to you, Gary Taubes. Gary, you need to write books and make YouTube videos, and you need to get off Twitter because you're wasting your time.
No, absolutely. There isn't a moment that I'm on Twitter where I'm not saying, Gary, I'm not repeating those words. I'm not so sure about the YouTube videos because, you know, I work in a – I'm a writing guy. I hate it, but that's what I do.
Yeah.
The flip side, it's funny. I had lunch yesterday with a cardiologist in San Francisco. It was the first time I'd been out in a year and a half. That's not true. First time I'd been out into San Francisco across the bay from us. And we were talking about this. I said, the flip side is we so rarely get to interact with these people in any way to have the kind of discussions we wish we could have all the time. And that ideally would have been had 50 years ago and 30 years ago and 20 years ago where you're pressure testing ideas. They never get you anywhere because we're all now locked into our dogma. We're locked into our belief systems. No one's changing their minds. And the ones who are least likely to change their minds are the ones who insist that they will.
Yep.
That they don't suffer from the same sort of intellectual phase lock that all of humanity has and science is characterized. But anyway, I think that's part of the interaction. The part of the... you know, what keeps pulling me back is this idea that I can actually have, looking at Sam's comment. Yeah, it is. but there's a bottom of the barrel and then there's a top of the barrel and you could float around at the top of the barrel for a while before you get pulled under. It's an opportunity. You know, if I were to call up Kevin Hall or John Speakman and say, can we just talk about this or invite me to NIH, let me lecture again on this and let's discuss this. 10 years ago, they would have done it. Now the sides are locked in. The people who are convinced you're wrong are the people who don't want to read your books and don't want to interact with you. I mean, there are even people, there's one influencer in the bodybuilding world who I invited myself onto his podcast, and he won't have me on his podcast, but he's always happy to argue with me. Not argue, but insist I'm an idiot on Twitter. And it's like, the people you want to talk to are the people you disagree with, right?
Right.
Yep. So Twitter does give you an opportunity before it digresses into, and it's always frustrating because nobody ever answers the hard questions, and they'll say the same about me that I say about them, you know. But that's what keeps pulling you back is this idea. And then with me, every once in a while, I'll get someone who asks a thoughtful question. Today it was an adjunct professor, so he's kind of an academic, who suggested an experiment. Now, I love it when people suggest experiments because now we're in science land instead of religion. So I said, that won't work. Too many variables are changing. Here's the flip side. And then it slowly digressed into, you know, the usual crap cesspool. But it started with, if somebody's going to suggest an experiment, I noticed it, I went on Twitter, then it makes sense to go back and to say, yep, that's great. As long as we're suggesting experiments and discussing what the different theories would predict, now we're moving towards science.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I would just caution all of our keto cousins out there, be open-minded. I love Ted Naiman. I don't agree with him, but it's fine. For a certain subset of the population, high protein may be the solution for you. For others, I feel like high fat is a solution. For some people, need dairy-free. For some people, no nuts. For some people, you can have keto bread. What an oxymoron. For other people, you don't need to play around with any of the fake pseudo foods. You need to eat real whole foods with one ingredient. There's so many things, and basically what we're all doing is stumbling around in the dark, trying to rediscover the proper human diet. That's what we're trying to do. And science should be nothing but a help, but it's often a hindrance the way it's currently practiced. It shouldn't be that way, but it currently is, especially in nutrition research. And that's sad to say, but I think it's true. Any final thoughts about the kind of the ivory tower of nutrition research? What needs to happen there?
That's an interesting question. And the answer is, I don't know, that we're now moving towards personalized medicine, right? And personalized nutrition. The NIH is throwing $100 and some million of personal nutrition research. The good news is that they're depending a lot on the use of continuous glucose monitors. So as long as they're looking at lowering blood sugar in their personalized nutrition, it's going to be hard to avoid ending up where we are.
Exactly.
I don't know what the answer is. There are people out there who are still doing a lot of clinical trials, and the ketogenic diet has sparked, you know, a couple hundred clinical trials. They're virtually pick a chronic disease state from, you know, cancer to depression or psychosis or bad acne or you name it. Somebody out there is doing a clinical trial with a ketogenic diet to see how well it works better than whatever the comparator is. So, in that sense, we're making progress. I think, like I said, it depends on the pushback from the, the vegan community, which I think is, you know, rightly or wrongly, more concerned with the well-being of the animals that we eat than the humans that they're talking to, the pushback from the environmental community. But ultimately, you know, the world is full of people who want to get healthy, who need to get healthy. And now they're not. Now, what we accomplished is we got people to realize they can try this way of eating and it's not going to kill them.
Exactly.
That 20 years ago, that was this, you eat Atkins for 3 months and you have your heart attack, you're dead. Look what happened to Atkins. You know, now the world is full of people who are willing to try it.
Exactly.
Full of people who know people who have tried it and benefited and they want the same benefits. So, you know, I think that more than I went into this when I co-founded the Nutrition Science Initiative 10 years ago now. I thought, you know, we really need clinical trials to shift the thinking in the academic community, and then it could trickle down to the medical, to the doctors. I acknowledge that, that Nusi did not succeed, to put it kindly, in accomplishing that. And now I think it's going to trickle up from, you know, the patients to the physicians, yep. from physician to physician, and slowly, even with the American Diabetes Association, the head of the American Diabetes Association acknowledges eating a low-carb diet.
Yep. You know? It's on page 187 of yeah. their latest nutritional guidelines, but yeah, it's actually in there. That's true. Yeah. And so any healthcare provider watching this, you are within the standard of care to offer a low carbohydrate diet to your diabetic patient, either type 1, type 2, LADA. It is in the manual. It's way back in the back, but it is there that it is an option. And I predict as years go forward, Gary, that it'll keep moving closer to the front and it'll keep expanding slowly, gently, very subtly. There'll never be a press conference with the American Diabetes.
In 20 years and already you're seeing people saying, yeah, we knew it all along. I love that when people, you know, I argue against this energy balance theory and then people respond, well, nobody ever believed that. Nobody ever believed the calorie is a calorie.
Really?
Like they did 20 years ago when I started this, you know, it's sort of in that sense, you know, the by us winning, that means that patients and individuals out there who struggle with these diseases can see that this is a viable dietary therapy that they could approach, that they could try, and if it works for them. And then our books like ours, help them understand how to do it right, which is vitally important. Because we don't want people, you know, when we see it fail, the question is, does it fail because people don't know what they're doing? Are they, you know, are they approaching this the right way? Are they thinking about it the right way? Are they eating the wrong foods, thinking they're eating the right foods? And then, you know, so we've taken away the fear for the most part.
Yes. And I think that's very powerful to remove that, oh my God, you'll die factor from the table.
Yeah. Yeah. And now the problem is, oh my God, you're ruining the environment. Well,
yeah. Now you're killing the world, not just killing.
Okay, yourself. I'll get an electric car. I'll walk more. That's good for me, I think.
And, absolutely.
I was thinking of giving away my car when the lease runs out next year, and
get a bike. Yeah, just go green.
No, I have a bike. The problem is, you know, where we live in Oakland, it's very hilly.
Get a good bike then. Yeah. So guys, the book is The Case for Keto. And I actually linked to this book and to all of Gary's books in the show notes. They're down here on YouTube, up there on Facebook. I don't know where they're at on Periscope. But thank you guys so much for joining us. Thanks for doing this, Gary. I can't wait to listen to your new book when it comes out. So make sure it's on Audible. And any final words? I've got all your links in the show notes. Any final words, words of advice, words of wisdom for the listeners?
Just thank you, Kent, for being involved with your sort of unique combination of humor and intellect. And
My wife calls that bullshit.
You mean it's bullshit that it's you? Yeah. Well, okay. We won't. Yeah. I think your wife and my wife would probably get along.
I think probably, yes.
Anyway, no, it's just, you know, the people are already watching your show are already believers, right? So, you know, my word, just if you've got people in your life who, you know, are struggling with obesity, overweight, diabetes, you know, chronic disease, just, you know, get them, try and get them to read these books. Just say, look, I'm not saying anything. I don't know if this is right or wrong, but this helped me.
Yes.
And I think it can help you. And I think these are good places to start. The Case for Keto, Lies My Doctor Told Me. You know, I think you should consider trying it.
Totally agree. Thank you so much, Gary Taubes. You guys get one of his books. And if nothing else, buy a copy of one of his books for your doctor.
I wrote The Case for Keto as much for your doctor as I did for.
Exactly. That's the one. All right, Gary Taubes, thank you so very much for doing this. Guys, this will be available for replay. You're always welcome to share this if you think it'll help a friend or a family member. You never know what message is going to resonate with them. So maybe this is the one you should share. Thanks, Gary. See you next time.
Thank you, Ken. Take care.
Bye.